It's Wednesday, October 17th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ryan Thomas. On our program this week, President Trump's media tour. Why is he suddenly so available to reporters? And how well are those appearances going? We'll talk about it. Facebook makes strides to limit misinformation ahead of the midterms. We'll go over what some of those are and what it says it's going to do next. And after the big polling mistakes in 2016, what is Nate Silver saying now about what might be 3 weeks from now? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up. But let's start the show today the same way that we did last week, talking about what's been going on in Turkey and the status of the investigation into the disappearance and likely death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. There's evidence now that he was in the embassy and that he did die there. In fact, audio tapes coming out today, too.
Yeah, and so far, at least, as the audio tapes have been heard by a few Turkish journalists and probably intelligence officials as well, not by any American journalists, to my knowledge. Nonetheless, those tapes purport to show him being tortured. In fact, there's even a quote in one Turkish publication of the consul general who's complaining, saying, take this outside, take it outside the consulate. I could get in trouble. And allegedly, one of the hit team says to him, shut up if you want to live. That consul general has now been called back to Riyadh. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of specificity of detail. That, along with the fact that the New York Times and the Washington Post especially have used social media accounts, mobile apps used by folks in the Middle East and a lot of other sources to piece together where several of these people are who mysteriously flew into Istanbul, then flew out within 24 hours or so, and showed that they were in fact members of the prince's security team. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of details there that counter this, whatever narrative it is of the moment that the Saudis and our own president are putting out there.
Right. I mean, it's good reporting kicking into gear here and sort of busting through the narrative that this was 15 rogue agents who just happened upon the embassy. That is increasingly looking like that is not the case.
So, Mike, you had brought up our own president's statements. He told Leslie Stahl on the 60 Minutes piece that aired on Sunday evening that there was going to be a full investigation, that the United States was taking this very seriously, even sent Secretary of State Pompeo to go and look into this himself, to meet with the Saudi king. But it's kind of hard to say now if this investigation is really being pushed by the U.S. government or if in some ways, the administration is also helping to engage in some of the cover-up.
And it's hard to know exactly what's happening, of course, because diplomats are going to be diplomatic. Presidents are sometimes going to be diplomatic, too. So what they say versus what they know could be two different things. But when you see the Secretary of State coming out of his meeting with the Crown Prince and the King and saying, well, if it's unlawful behavior, it's unacceptable. You mean murdering and dismembering somebody, right? You have the president first saying, well, there would be severe punishment. But then later he's saying, well, it might have just been rogue agents. So basically parroting what the Saudis are saying. And then he even went further yesterday and compared the stories about Khashoggi to what happened to Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court justice. So this is not normal diplo speak that we're going through here.
The attitude of the executive branch has been astonishingly blasé about something so horrific. The other thing to think about is what is the legislative branch doing? And there have been a number of senators touring television studios speaking like they're going to take a harder line on the issue. Ben Sass, Lindsey Graham have been given various interviews. But we know that our legislative branch at the moment tends to show a lot of deference to the executive branch. So whether they will do anything, it seems unlikely based on precedent.
I mean, at the very least, we have confirmation through our own U.S. intelligence sources that the U.S. intelligence sources, knew ahead of time that the Saudi government was looking to kidnap Khashoggi and take him back to Saudi Arabia. And so one would imagine that people in the White House also knew that. You also, then, you have it all the way down to this situation now where there are accusations that the Saudis sent in a cleanup team and repainted, you know, places, and whether or not they would allow the Turkish investigators to come in and search for blood with various technologies. So clearly there is something going on there. But in the end, what I wonder is whether this narrative that the New York Times and CNN seem to have picked up on with their sources, that in the end, the Saudis will acknowledge some sort of, you know, interrogation that went wrong, which also doesn't seem to follow any of the evidence that's come out so far.
Well, and when an interrogation that went wrong, that was a planned kidnapping, is the cover story, I mean, that is really quite astonishing.
It is astonishing. So on the face of this, it's a media story. We're talking about a journalist who's gone missing and likely murdered. There are multiple media angles coming out to this. We've talked about the government response. There has also been response in the private sector. Several American news organizations pulling out of a conference sponsored by the Saudi Arabian government.
News organizations and banks and a lot of other folks as well will note that so far Fox Business has
it
not
is the one to pretty much not to.
But everybody else has, and what it was is this event that's being called Davos in the Desert, basically all kinds of government and business and media folks coming together to talk about the crown prince, the heir to be to the throne in Saudi Arabia, and his efforts to modernize the country. They did it last year. This year, a lot of folks are pulling out for obvious reasons. I wonder, when we've moved on to the next big story of the week or month, what's going to happen 6 months from now or a year from now when this event is being held? Will the media folks and others refrain from going then? Because frankly, Saudi Arabia's record, even minus what happened to Mr. Khashoggi, kidnapped the prime minister of Lebanon, you know, all kinds of human rights abuses, and yet all these media figures were going to be there until this happened.
Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia is an extraordinarily repressive regime within the region. So even prior to this event, it is quite bizarre that
I'm not saying that is a good thing. That it took this long for women to be able to drive. I'm reacting to your repressive regime.
Indeed, but a lot of the women that led that campaign have been jailed for dissent.
Yeah.
So there's the illusion of freedom. And there is something a little bit hypocritical. It's sort of like the Goldilocks effect, right? Just the right amount of autocracy, not too much. We're willing to indulge you on this much. It is a little bit sticks in our craw a little bit. It also does sort of bust the narrative that many figures in the West, notably Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, have been pushing, that this is a more open, less repressive regime. The evidence for that, based on how Saudi Arabia has conducted itself within the region, prosecuting a war in Yemen that is a humanitarian disaster, that narrative is thankfully sort of starting to look a bit busted.
But now that the veil's been pulled back, I mean, you have to look at what are the motives for our government, the Turkish government, to continue to allow this narrative to be out there. Is it arms sales? I mean, we know the president said he didn't want to lose $100 billion in arms sales. Is it gas prices? You know, trying to hold down the gas prices while Trump tries to put more sanctions on Iran? It could be that. Could it be that the president and his family have personal... We don't know what the reasons are, but none of them seem to stack up to... I mean, forget being Pollyannish about what, you know, a perfect world. Even people who are pretty jaded would think there are certain moral standards that we should be paying lip service to.
Yeah.
Well, the president has been making the rounds, being more willing to sit down and talk to reporters than really at almost any other point in his presidency. Sunday night, he was on 60 Minutes talking to Leslie Stahl about a pretty wide range of topics, including what happened to Khashoggi, the economy, relations with other nations, including North Korea and China, the Kavanaugh confirmation, and a bunch of others. This was the third time that Stahl has done a one-on-one interview with Donald Trump. And in this 60 Minutes overtime clip, a web extra, she said that this interview felt different than any of the others, and that there were moments when she felt like maybe she'd struck a nerve.
I think it was more when I would try to bring him back to the question I asked. And that got on his nerves a little bit. I'm going to try one more time. Okay.
I know, Leslie, you don't have to try again. I know exactly what you're saying.
Well, answer my question.
The answer is this.
At times, he seemed to be trying to filibuster you.
Well, you know something? He was trying to filibuster me. But I have never interviewed a politician ever that didn't try to filibuster me. Do you believe that the Russians interfered in the 2016 campaign, election?
They meddled, but I think China meddled too.
But and why
I think
do you
other
say
countries,
China meddled
And you
too?
Want to know something?
Why
else?
Do you say China? Why don't you just say the
you.
Russians meddled?
Because I think China meddled also. And I think, frankly, China
this
is a bigger problem.
You're diverting the whole Russian
I'm
thing.
I'm not doing
you
anything.
Are.
I'm
are.
Saying Russia.
When you were walking to the Oval Office, you tried to press him on whether he'd pledge not to fire Robert Mueller.
Yeah. Will you pledge that you will not shut down the Mueller investigation?
Well, I don't pledge anything.
Man, he didn't want to answer that. He didn't want to pledge. He said, I'm not going to pledge on 60 Minutes.
I don't want to pledge. Why should I pledge to you? If I pledge, I'll pledge. I don't have to pledge to you. But
well,
I have no intention of that.
You're not pledging to me. Yeah, he didn't like that one either.
He didn't want to pledge on 60 Minutes because it was 60 Minutes. If he then goes and does something, there is no more credible outlet to come right back and hold him to it.
Well, 60 Minutes is a credible show. Leslie Stahl is a very, very good journalist. But I think it was an illustration. They described it in the clip as a filibuster, which I think is one of the best ways that I've heard Trump's interview style described. It is like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. He's evasive. He's not bothered by facts.
Lindsey Graham called him a street fighter in a slightly different context, too.
Indeed, indeed. It was also a very wide-ranging interview. They covered so many topics. So rather than sort of drilling down into a couple of specific ones, it covered a lot of ground. So I don't know necessarily what new ground was broken. That's not any criticism of Leslie Stahl, just the fact that he is a very difficult person to interview.
It's interesting to me, too, because there was, at least in some media quarters, this narrative that Trump needed to get out there and do this media blitz. One excuse being made was, well, even Fox News Channel is not carrying all of his rallies anymore.
Look, they stopped making good television,
right,
though. They were the same thing every single night in primetime. If you're Sean Hannity, you want that time back to be able to rabble rouse.
No, I mean, my point too, because he would also call into Fox and Friends in the morning and take up so much time, and he couldn't run any commercials. They're losing money. But you know, a lot of people thought that was a reason why Trump was doing this, or maybe he was doing it because he was worried about the midterms. I think Trump was out there, as always, showing that he likes to manipulate the media. I mean, he was doing what he normally does. And, you know, you can say that he was being asked tough questions, having to deflect questions about lots of different things, but that's just the way he rolls.
Yeah, I mean, asking for evidence or asking for follow-up questions is almost futile because the shame that is a natural human response to being caught in a lie is not a characteristic of his personality. So if you have that kind of shamelessness, it's impossible to interview somebody like that according to the traditional ways that journalism is done.
There was one aspect of this, of his media blitz, if you want to call it that, that I found really interesting. You had a couple of articles linking to it, and that was USA Today basically giving him free rein to write his own op-ed and not fact-checking it ahead of time, getting called on it after it ran because it was full of factually questionable assertions, shall we say. And, you know, I think that was a really interesting instance of where there was a good argument within the media about when it's appropriate or not appropriate to tell a president, you can write something, but if we don't believe that it's factually accurate, we're not going to publish it.
Right. I mean, I get the argument to run it. The argument to run it is that it's the president. But that isn't the sum total of, you know, the ethical decision-making calculation.
The commitment for truthiness on the opinion page is just as high as it is on the front page
Absolutely.
Of the newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, we tell our students that, you know, journalism's first obligation is to the truth and its first loyalty is to citizens. That obviously applies to the news section, but it applies also to the opinion section, right? You can opine to your heart's content, but you don't have a license to make up new facts on the opinion page.
And it wasn't just a matter of them publishing it. Now, I don't always agree with Jay Rosen, the NYU journalism professor, but he said something that I think is pretty much spot on about that whole thing. He said, first USA Today, we publish it, brimming with dubious claims and falsehoods. Then we share the juiciest bits on social. Then we fact check it later. Then we promote the fact check to critics and fans. It seems like a sequencing problem. And I would agree with that, that yes. It was out of sequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, the closer that we get to November 6th, the more we're going to see what looks like and feels like political stunts meant to prove something. Late Monday, it was Elizabeth Warren announcing she had taken a DNA test, is challenged by the president, to prove that she is a Native American. The DNA test showed that she likely does have some ancestral roots, but it's really served to show that those tests don't make us this or that, and it's shown just how unaware of how Native American nations view citizenship.
Just wholly unhelpful for any national leader to cling to DNA to determine or to establish that they're Native American.
So that was Chuck Hoskin Jr. He is the Secretary of State of the Cherokee Nation. He was trying to explain that simply because there is the evidence of DNA that might or might not come from certain regions of the world doesn't necessarily qualify you for citizenship within a nation, and that the Cherokee Nation, as is lots of other Native American tribes and nations, really taking offense to this entire situation.
Well, I think it was an attempt to get in front of the narrative ahead of a possible presidential bid in 2020. The president has used the term Pocahontas as a criticism of Elizabeth Warren, so it's an attempt to sort of reclaim that narrative. But it legitimizes criticisms that are made in bad faith. And the idea that Elizabeth Warren can put this video out and the president will say, oh, well, I guess problem solved, you've produced these facts, I'm not going to make that criticism anymore, seems bizarre. And along the way, what Elizabeth Warren has inadvertently done is offended the Native American community, who do not recognize DNA testing as a legitimate way of establishing a connection to a tribal nation. And so you end up in this bizarre spectacle of people on Twitter, Elizabeth Warren fans on Twitter, lecturing the Cherokee Nation on what constitutes tribal heritage, and to do this before the midterms. It is very, very bizarre.
And it's like the worst case example of the criticism of the Democratic Party focusing on identity politics. I mean, what has this got to do with anything? She's not stood up particularly loudly for Native American issues or rights at any point before now. Right. Why bother to even bring this up and cement those stereotypes with some of the people who have voted for the president and probably will vote for him again? It just seems to me that if the election turns in 2020, if the election turns on this kind of stuff and whether or not she or whoever the Democratic nominee is can stand up to the insults of Trump, that's not a very strong position to be in.
Okay, well, we've had President Trump talking about the Russians and the Chinese meddling in the election in that 60 Minutes interview, and we talked about Elizabeth Warren taking the DNA test. All of these are the types of things that might very easily lend themselves to sharing on social media platforms like Facebook in a big game of telephone. Facebook is doubling down on fake news and misinformation in these final weeks before we go to the polls, claiming that it will ban misinformation on voting. And I looked at that headline at first, and my thought was, you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube. And then realize that maybe the headline wasn't telling the full story there either.
Yeah, when you read the story really carefully, what Facebook has actually pledged to do is to ban falsehoods about the voting process. For example, if somebody uses their platform to say, hey, you can vote via text or
message.
Twitter, right? Or somehow sends a message saying, well, there's a lot of violence going on down at your polling place, you might be careful. That's the kind of stuff that they're going to ban. But by the time the ban actually took effect, the impact probably, because this is kind of stuff that would be done on election day, is probably moot anyway. So I don't know that they're, I mean, Facebook is doing other things to try to counter fake news, but this particular announcement doesn't seem like all that much to me.
Yeah, I think we've talked in the show about some trepidation about Facebook sort of identifying viewpoints. And so it, I think it sort of took those wider criticisms to heart, not our specific criticisms. I don't know if they're listening to us, but I mean the wider criticism.
We know people at Facebook.
Maybe
they might be
influential, but
We've got reach.
Certainly. But this very sort of narrow approach about sort of the process of voting. And so I suppose on the one hand, you can commend that. But is it too little, too late? Is it that information sort of already out there?
One of the other things that has happened in the past week or so, it has taken an action of killing off more than 800 accounts that had been seen as pushing political spam. I don't know how much that's going to do, though. We're still seeing it.
No, and assuming that that the candidates and their supporters are going to be spreading plenty of lies and misinformation in the last days of the campaign, Facebook isn't, and maybe for reasons they can justify, can't do very much about that. So the problem is much larger than this particular story.
Okay, well, the closer we get, the more prolific the polling is going to get, the more prolific the prognostication that's going to get to, or will it? The Washington Post Margaret Sullivan sat down with Nate Silver to get his take on what we might be able to predict, or even more likely, what we can't. He's not feeling too good about what he's seeing in the coverage so far in both the horse race coverage of the campaigns or the polling, and kind of where there's disparities and how some of that polling coverage is affecting the horse race coverage.
I mean, it's interesting to me because it's kind of like the last story where you talked about maybe the headline is not accurately capturing the details of the story. I am willing to give some of the professional pollsters credit for saying the polls now are pretty well done. It's the interpretation. And so he's, for example, Nate Silver's talking about the fact that it looks more likely than not that the Democrats will capture the House. It seems more likely than not that the Republicans will retain the Senate. But then we like to use shorthand in the way we tell these poll stories that get way far away from what the statistics allow us to truly predict. And that's where the problem comes in.
Yeah, it's the difficulty of qualitatively describing quantitative data. So
there's our researcher.
There you go. So so if the example that is used in the piece is Beto O'Rourke running in Texas. And so Nate Silver and others had him at a 35% chance.
And he was running against Ted Cruz.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. And he that was 35% chance was described as a toss-up. 25% when it's been downgraded to 25%, all of a sudden he's a dead man walking, right? So but what Nate Silver's point is that is a dramatic shift in rhetoric, but not a dramatic shift in on the quantitative side. And that is dangerous from a voter turnout perspective, because if I was a voter in Texas, and I've already decided I'm not going to vote for Ted Cruz, but I might vote for Beto O'Rourke, but the narrative that I'm hearing is that he has no chance. Well, if I've got a long day at work, got to pick the kids up from school and stuff, I may not go out to vote. So we need to be very careful about these kinds of things.
I will also say, though, that the underlying notion that the science of polling is fairly accurate, I still think is an open question, especially in a midterm election when you're not doing, even highly accurate statewide polls in every state. You've got margin of error problems, you've got sampling error problems that are coming up, and you're also going to see something really different this election night, and it's going to be predictive, I think, of what happens in 2020. The Associated Press, which for a long time did its own exit polling day of, not doing it anymore. And the reason they're not doing it anymore is that exit polls don't capture all the people who voted days or weeks before the polls close. Certain people, like Republican voters, don't want to talk to exit pollsters. So they're come up with this very complicated series of online surveys and telephone surveys, which they hope when they bring it all together will create a more accurate rendition of what the voters are going to do. But this is the first really big election where that system's been tested.
Okay, well, we have a few minutes left, so let's try and squeeze in a couple of non-political stories. Teach for America has a pretty good record of getting young teachers into rural and impoverished communities. Now the journalism equivalent, Report for America, is just about ready to roll. We talked about this when it was first announced, and now that it is, let's remind our audience what the idea is here and what's going to happen.
It's an initiative to put journalists into under-journalized, if that's an invented word, communities. News deserts is a new term, and there's a link on our links blog that folks can check out about that. But to basically place journalists in these communities, providing half of the funding that then the local news organization provides the other half to sustain local journalism where local journalism is being cut to the bone.
And there's no question there's a need. I mean, you have a link to a study that the University of North Carolina did, which shows that there are more than 1,300 communities in the United States that have no newspapers. And there's a whole lot more than that that only have one, and the one probably has cut back its staff and its pages because of all the economic problems. It's a great idea to try to tackle this problem, but Report for America, as great of an idea as it is, they placed 13 people this year. They're going to place about twice that many this coming year, and they hope maybe to place up to 250 journalists the year after that, a presidential election year. The problem is huge, and this might be one small attempt to address it, but it's not nearly going to be enough.
Okay, so one last thing. We have about a minute and a half or so. Big day yesterday here at the Missouri School of Journalism. We had our annual Missouri Honor Medals that were handed out for exemplary service and exemplary service to both the journalism and strategic communication fields. Our honorees this year spent the day with us, spoke with our students, taught classes open to the public. Some even sat with me on a panel yesterday. Some of your biggest takeaways from the day?
I enjoyed the Women in Media panel, actually.
Thanks, Ryan.
I appreciate that.
You're
welcome. I had a schedule conflict, so couldn't sort of make it, but thanks to the magic of the internet, was able to watch late, and that was a highlight for me. The idea of these five women with very different experiences, stitching that together into a common narrative that was helpful for our students, I think is very good.
I enjoyed that too, and as last year when you did it, it seemed to me that there was a little bit of, if you can generalize at all, a little bit of a different take from the older women on the panel and the younger. For this time, you had a younger journalist from the Indianapolis Star talking about their investigation that led to the downfall of Dr. Larry Nassar and problems for USA Gymnastics. And she was sort of much less, I think, willing to talk about all of the impediments to women in journalism than were some of the women who'd been in the business a lot longer. That was interesting to me. Another session I thought was really fascinating was from kind of a local guy. So Peter Hessler grew up here in Columbia, dad, longtime professor in the sociology department. He went on to live in China for many years, wrote 3 award-winning books about that, and coming back and telling his stories about the value of challenging yourself to live in another culture, to study people that you really, you know, otherwise would never get a chance to meet. I thought that was pretty fascinating, too.
The buzz around some of Joel Sartori's sessions from yesterday, too, in his project arc, especially after, if you saw 60 Minutes Sunday night, you saw that after the President Trump interview, he was also profiled. So I think there was a lot more interest and buzz in hearing some of the things he had to talk about and to see some of his photos following kind of a little bit of pregame that we had on that, thanks to CBS. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics that we talked about on today's program. There information there that's on our links blog. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. We also invite you to like us on Facebook so you can go back through the magic of the internet and watch the show again, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We're going to be taking a few weeks off, but we'll be back with you on Wednesday, November 7th, for a closer look at the midterm elections. We'll be looking at who won, who lost, and how it was all covered. So we will see you then.